Good morning. I'm WILL-TV Program Director David Teal, and I'm your guest host for this hour of Focus 580. On the third Monday of each month, we take your home improvement questions, and joining us in the studio this morning is Scott Spies of Spies Home Inspection in Champaign, Illinois. The number to call in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Outside the area, anywhere in the United States, you can call our toll-free line. That's 800-222-9455. That's 800-222-WILL. Good morning, Scott.
David, good morning. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, no, it's a pleasure. Now I have to admit right up front, I am not a home improvement expert by any means.
Well, hopefully we'll get some information to you, get any questions we might have come in answered.
And, I always have a lot of questions. We just had our basement floor put in again a second time after last year's flood, and so it's been about a year, and we had somebody come in and put in tile. But as I was saying before before we got started this morning, I said the most I've ever done was have to clean out our sump tank underneath the basement sink after they got done with sawing all that tile, got it filled with dust.
Well, that just makes me happy that you actually have a sewage ejection system for your laundry sink, because a lot of the lower-level laundry and lower-level plumbing in this area goes into the storm drain, because our, particularly in Urbana, our sewer lines actually go out above the floor level, and we don't have several houses out there that don't have proper sewage ejection lift stations such as that would take that water up and into the sewer system. All the new construction that we've got going in Champaign-Urbana with a basement requires a sewage lift system so that we reduce the chances of sewage backups back into basement areas.
Oh, very good. See, now I've learned something new already, and we've already got several calls lined up here. People are right on board. Oh, wow. Four of them already. So let's go ahead. Let's take line one in Champaign. Good morning.
Good morning. I have a tree in front of the house that has been getting taller and taller, so that the earth is now inclining more toward the house. I'm getting more water in the basement. And I've noticed that around the edges of the house, it seems to be inclining a little more toward the house. I wondered if building up the earth around the house would help, or is there another solution?
Kind of depends on the type of tree, how much of an effect that's going to be, and how big the tree does get. Usually the root system is slightly larger than the canopy of the tree. In other words, if the sun were pointing straight down, the shade that you get from the tree, the roots usually try and get out past that canopy to pick up rain and such, and can get towards the foundation. And most of the silver maples that we have around here do tend to have the root systems up on surface, so they start raising things. And yes, you could raise the soil by the house to try and correct your drainage, but you don't want to get the soil too high around the house. You need to make sure that there's probably 4 to 6 inches of the foundation showing from your siding down to the soil, and then from that point to a point, say, 6 feet or 10 feet out, you want another 6 to 8 inches of drop. So if that tree keeps coming up high enough to where we can't build that soil up next to the house, then, yes, we do start getting into a little bit of a problem, and you may have to either cut a couple of the roots and try and put a swale or a low spot between the tree and the house.
Mm-hmm.
What kind of tree is it, do you know?
I think it's an elm tree,
yeah. And
okay. It has gotten quite large since I've been here.
Well, good. This is Tree City USA here in Urbana, and for several years, I know. It's like nice to see some of these big trees. Some of these,
yeah.
Oh yeah, I get into a lot of new neighborhoods that have very few trees, and thankful they've got some that are starting to grow. But yeah, if they get too close to the foundation, they can create problems. Mm-hmm. One of the things you might want to do is to check and make sure that your gutters are cleaned. Of course, the bigger the tree is, the more debris falls in there, the more it tends to fill up the gutters.
Mm-hmm.
And make sure that the downspouts are extended far enough away to where they get out or away from where that improper slope is.
Mm-hmm. Somebody would need to come and check this and give me advice, no?
Well, that could be done. You know, if it's something you feel is more than what you want to handle by taking a look out there and seeing what can be done, then yes.
I think it's more than I can do myself.
All right. You might try several of the nurseries here in town that are very good with doing the landscaping and stuff. Also would know enough about the tree to be able to hopefully save it and still get your proper drainage.
Okay. Thank you.
Thanks very much for your call. We're just going to go right on to line two in Champaign. Good morning. Line two.
Hello?
Ah, there you are. All right. Good morning.
Morning. How you doing? I had a question about roofing. I'm looking to re-roof this summer because my shingles are gone, and I was looking to maybe go with the metal shingles. And I was just curious to hear your input on the metal shingles and what you think about them. I'm specifically talking about the Decra metal shingles.
Okay, it's a brand name. I've heard of them. I haven't done much research on them, so I'm going to have to defer a little bit of that to, I don't know, finding some stuff on the internet. But metal shingles in general and metal roofing, I do like. They do have a good high-quality finish to them in most cases. They are relatively durable. The only thing we really have problems with metal roofing in this area is moisture condensation. If you've got a high humidity level in the house, the metal shingle, you can actually get moisture condensing on the backside, and I've seen it rot sheathing and such. So you need to make sure you've got very good attic ventilation when you put on a metal roof. You would have to check with the manufacturer. They may recommend some type of like a tar paper or even a house wrap, something underneath it to help keep moisture away from the roof decking. If you've got a crawl space on the house, definitely get a vapor barrier or something in the crawl space over the top of the soil surface, because most moisture condensation problems that originate that you see in the attics or roofing area actually originate from the crawl spaces areas. As a general rule, metal roofing, it's becoming more popular. It's a lot more expensive than an asphalt shingle, but it is a longer life shingle. So it's something, if your budget will allow, that I would consider looking into it.
Great. Thank you so much.
And thank you. And we have a call on the toll-free line, line four in Lafayette. Good morning.
Good morning. Why do the water pipes in the basement sometimes growl or buzz when I'm running water?
Usually that's an indication, not necessarily of the water pipes, but something in the valve itself, whichever faucet happens to be on. The most common one I find is the toilet valve. When the toilet is running, you can oftentimes get a flutter on the valve. And water being a hydraulic fluid and can't compress, so if it's moving and all of a sudden the valve at the other end starts vibrating, say a piece of rubber that's not in place, the valve seat is not sealing well with the valve, then we can start getting that rumble, which will start a vibration in the pipes. What I would try and do is try and isolate which one of the water valves in your house is creating the problem, and I would start at that valve, and that's probably where you're going to find the issue is.
Okay. And finally, could I ask, we get conflicting instructions on various appliances run by battery. Some say keep the appliance on the charging stand all the time, and some say only until you've completely charged and then take it off. Is there a general practice for that?
Well, that's kind of going to depend on the type of battery that you've got. The lithium ion batteries are not supposed to maintain a memory, but the NiCad batteries will, if you leave them on a charger all the time, they will develop a memory where they'll only discharge to a certain point and then quit working. They'll drop, the voltage will drop very quickly. On the NiCad style batteries, yes, it's the best idea to run them all the way dead. So when you use them, you put them on a charger, you bring them up to a full charge, you disconnect them from a charger and you use them until very close to dead, and then try and leave them on until they go all the way down and then recharge them. Like say the nickel cadmium batteries that they've got out there, the lithium ion batteries are not supposed to have that memory issue. So things like the new phones and such, you can leave them on a charger more often. So it kind of depends on what type of battery, but for the most part, if I'm playing with a battery, I like to, if it's on a charger, I unplug it and like to let it run down on a fairly regular basis, once a week or so, and just keep the battery cycled so it has its full life.
All right. Thank you, sir.
And thank you. And we're talking again this morning to Scott Spies of Spies Home Inspection here in Champaign. And we're taking your home improvement questions. You can call us at 333-9455 or our toll-free line at 800-222-9455. 9455. And we have a caller in Kankakee on line one. Line one, you're on.
Good morning. How
are
you?
Good morning.
I've got a similar question to the last caller, only it's my breaker box. It's making humming noises, and the breaker box is located in a walk-in closet in our bedroom, you know, next to our bathroom, and you can be in the bathroom and literally hear this humming noise. And I'm kind of wondering if there's something going on there that, you know, I should be paying attention to. Could it be drawing extra power, or is it anything to be concerned about?
Being in an electrical box, the first thing I'd have to say is yes, you should be concerned about it. The electrical box should not make any humming noises unless it is something like a transformer. Quite often they'll have the low voltage transformer for the doorbell, which is a 24 volt AC system. That transformer could be your buzz.
Well, we don't have a doorbell.
Okay, well, if you don't have a doorbell, I would probably get an electrician to take a look at it, because most things in an electrical service do not create a buzz or a noise other than, like I say, a low-voltage transformer. It could be an indication of a breaker with a poor connection internally, or a breaker with a poor connection to the main bus bar, where we're getting a little bit of almost an arcing. So, yeah, I would definitely, if you're getting a noise or a buzz from there, I would definitely get an electrician to come out and take a look at it and see what he can find for you.
Would it be smart if I can turn this off at the pole and then come back inside, take the front panel off, and just, you know, try to tighten up the breakers and see if that kills that noise first before I spend money for an electrician to come out? Or
well, probably if you're familiar with enough with electricity to play with a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, I used to work as an electrician years and years ago, so I mean, I'm you know what I'm saying, I'll definitely have it shut off out of the pole or something like that.
Well, I would probably pull the front cover. Yeah, I'd probably pull the front cover while you still had power, because that's not going to affect anything. And look for any indications of any overheat, any wires that might have a little bit of melted insulation. You could actually put your fingers on the breaker throw-offs and see if any one of them is above room temperature, and see if you can't isolate a little bit more about where that might be.
Right.
When I did indicate the doorbell transformer, there's also a transformer in the house for the furnace. Most of the time they're located in the furnace, but occasionally I will find those low-voltage transformers, again, in that service panel. So when you pull the cover off of it, and then if you decide to actually start doing something, yes, you should turn the power off either at the main, or if you want to play with the main feed connections, you'll have to turn off at the pole for safety.
Right. Okay. Appreciate it, sir.
Certainly. Thank you.
Thanks.
And we have a caller waiting on line two in Champaign. Line two.
Hello.
Hello.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Yes. I have a question about, in order to try to improve my WILL TV reception, I would like to put a tripod up on the roof of my house and so on and so forth, on the roof itself. And I was wondering if you would cover some do's and don'ts. I've done this sort of thing before, but it's been a long time, and I'd like to review, just from your point of view, if I was to do something like that, what would be a good way to go?
Well, to attach anything to a roof, of course, means putting a hole through the roof, and holes do tend to attract moisture. So you'll have to seal around the bolts. Usually the best bet is to position it where you want it, get your bolt started, then through your tripod, make sure everything's lined up, and then take it back up and put some silicone sealant underneath the base of your tripod, set it back down in that, put your bolts through it, and then cover the heads and around the legs there, then again with a silicone. You could use a roofing tar, but a roofing tar tends to dry after about 2 or 3 years of sunlight exposure. So something on the line of one of the silicone sealants would probably give you a longer-lasting seal, so you don't have to keep getting up there every couple of years and seal around it. Luckily, the bolts are fairly small, and they're going into the hole fairly tight, so we rarely get any significant leakage around them. But a little bit of preemptive sealing will help reduce any problems in the future. I think our caller got off the line for us.
All right. Well, you know, and this is going to come up quite a bit probably in the next few days, because several of the television stations locally are going to be turning off their analog transmitters after tomorrow. So we're not, because here at WILL, because it's actually the date has officially been delayed till June 12th, but several of the stations are going off anyway on the original date of February 17th. So I think there'll be a number of people up on the roof
very soon. And the thing to remember on that kind of stuff is to make sure that you get it anchored well enough that a good hefty wind doesn't try and pull it loose. Try and make sure it's located away from power lines and tree branches and such like that for safety. But yeah, a good sealant. Like I say, I like to set them on there. Either drill a pilot hole and start a bolt and then pull everything back off and put some silicone into the holes and put it back down.
And we have got a caller on our toll-free line, line 4 in Bloomington. Bloomington, you're on the air.
Yes, sir.
Yes.
Do you have a good way of telling if water coming in the basement is groundwater or a leaking pipe outside?
Yes, I do. City water is going to have a chlorine added to it, so you can actually get some pH test strips and test the water and see what kind of a pH balance you've got. And if it's going to be a city water, it will come back with a different reading than rainwater.
Okay, could you suggest what some of those readings might be?
Not off the top of my head.
Okay, but pH test strips.
Yeah, some pH test strips will tell you, because if there's any chlorine or anything in the water, it'll set that test strip will change colors on you, and you'll know whether or not it's a leaking pipe. Most of the time, if it's a pipe, it's going to be near where your main feed is. Mm-hmm. Generally, if we've got a water problem that's actually a city water, the main feed has got a kink or a bend from some settlement just outside the foundation.
Mm-hmm.
So if that's where your water level is, it's two things. First of all, when they dig the hole to bring in your main water line, they do have to disturb the soil fairly deep, and so you can end up with a soft area in the soil. So any drainage that goes towards that area can collect, so it could be a stormwater. But then again, if we get some excessive settlement, I've seen them kink or break the water lines coming in and get a slight leak there.
Okay.
All right. Well, good luck with that.
All right. Bye.
Thank you. And I'll give the phone numbers once again so we get the phone bank filled up. 333-9455 and 800-222-9455 is a toll-free line. We've got a caller on line 1 in Champaign. Good morning, Champaign.
Hello.
Hello.
Yes, and this is a small question in the scheme of things, but it's spooking me out. I have a doorbell. We have doorbells at work with a battery, I guess. And twice in the last week, this doorbell has rung at night. And since my husband's out of town, you know, I've gone to the door and peeked out, and there's nobody there. The first time I thought it was a prankster. And then it happened again last night, and I know I'm not hallucinating. I have a dog who barks, and I had a guest in the house. And he walked around the house, and he checked everything, and there isn't anyone around.
Well, any number of different little things could be doing that. Since it is a battery operated, it's putting out an electrical signal.
Yeah.
I suppose that something could be getting a little bit of RF interference or radio frequency interference, which could be setting it off.
Okay, but it's never happened in all these years. It's just happened in this, you know, in the last few days.
In the last few days, when we've been getting some of these late night freezes and high humidity, since we had our rain and such that we had earlier in the week, the humidity level outside is quite high. We get a little freezing. You could actually get a chance of some frost forming on your contacts to the point where it could make a contact intermittently. And of course, as soon as any electrical current passes through there from the battery, it's warm enough, it'll melt the frost right off of it.
This is inside. I mean, if this happens in the doorbell, in the fixture on the door, you mean?
The button on the outside, the one you use to activate,
okay.
Yeah.
And it's only happening with the front doorbell, so, you know, I don't know if that makes a difference. But so I just ignore this and it'll just go away?
Well, you probably have some corrosion or something on that doorbell button. You say you've had it for a couple of years.
Yeah.
If it can be taken apart and cleaned, a lot of them you can take cover off of and get to the contacts. If you can actually see or feel the contacts, you clean them very simply by sliding a dollar bill or something between them. That's just coarse enough to polish up the contacts.
Okay.
If you can't get to the contacts, you may have to get a new external button. But my guess is it's a moisture condensation or frost issue with the exterior button.
Okay, so this is not something bizarre. I mean, this does happen occasionally. Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, all right. Well, thank you very much.
Okay, well, thank you for calling in today.
I feel like we've been doing a little ghost busting this morning. But we've got a caller on line 2 from Muhammad. Good morning, Muhammad.
Yeah, Last Wednesday, when we had these 60-mile winds, I got a leak in my ceiling. And I'm wondering if this is a question of the flashing on that vent outside, or is this just something that will happen rarely because the wind is blowing in and, you know, you can't do a whole lot about that?
Well, I'm going to have to kind of guess with the second version. There are times when, in very certain weather conditions, that we can get more wind blowing through ridge vents, button vents. We can actually get, with a high wind like that, we can actually get water traveling uphill. Normally that would run down the shingles can actually get blown up behind shingles.
Yeah.
So you'll have to look at the area where the water stain is. Now, of course, water can travel quite a ways between shingles, between sheathing panels, between roofing papers, et cetera, before it actually comes out. So it's not always where the where you see the leak inside the house is not always where the leak is.
Yeah.
But it gives you a general idea to start looking, okay, if you've got a plumbing vent near there, it's quite possible that we have one of the rubber boots starting to get old enough to where it's cracked and corroded and it was blowing enough water to run down.
It's a new roof, and it's not it's not a plumbing vent. It's a vent, you know, to let air in.
Okay. Yeah, some of the button vents, if you've got you know, a certain wind condition or the right direction for the wind, you can actually blow some air in there. Did it do it while it was raining, or was it when we had have you noticed it while we were doing any snow, or was it just during the high winds?
No. It happened when it was raining and when it was blowing real bad. And it happened one other time about 5 years ago when the same thing happened. And so I'm wondering if it's just the wind and the rain that occurs, you know, once in a great while, that you can get a little water in there. My husband went up in the attic, and he said there was a slight drip, which he filled the hole where the drip was. It was a nail hole. So I don't know if that fixed it or if it's just something that's going to happen once in a great while when you get high winds.
My guess is that the water coming in the nail hole is actually water that's running down the sheathing from someplace else.
Yeah.
It, like I say, in that area, I doubt that fixing the nail hole from the inside actually fixed the leak because now the water is just going to find another place on the sheathing to come through.
Yeah.
So it wouldn't hurt to go up on the roof and take a look at some of the flashing and see if there's a piece that might need a little bit of sealant around it.
Uh-huh.
If it's something that happens very, very rarely, which it seems to be, and I'm assuming we're not talking about large quantities of water. We don't need to put a bucket or something underneath it.
No.
For very small quantities, usually what I run into on those button vents is like a snow blowing in or something like that. What I'll recommend is you take something, a sheet of plastic, say about 3 foot square, a plastic garbage bag that you cut open and lay out. If you put that underneath there, it'll collect a little bit of water that comes down. And then let it evaporate so that it doesn't come down and give you a water stain in your ceiling.
Yeah.
So this particularly works with snow where we get a little bit of snow blowing in through a vent and it kind of collects on the insulation. Well, if you put that sheet of plastic just in that one area, that'll...
In the attic, you mean?
Yeah, in the attic on top of the insulation.
Yeah.
That way we don't hold any moisture in the insulation.
Right.
The water will drip onto that plastic and then with time and presumably proper attic ventilation, that water will evaporate and dissipate rather than collect and come through and stain your ceiling.
Yeah. So just put a garbage bag or something over the insulation should solve the problem.
Well, yeah, ideally we need to get somebody on the roof to see if there's anything visible. Like I say, it's very likely that something, flashing is out of position, particularly on a new roof. But if they can't find anything, rather than smear roofing tar or sealant all over 3/4 of the roof trying to find it, the plastic bag in the attic will, as long as it's a small leak, that will usually take care of it and let it evaporate.
Yeah, it's just a small leak, but I, you know, it's cold outside, so I didn't go up on the roof to check.
That's probably a good idea, yes.
Yeah, I don't go up there until the weather gets warm, but I just, since it's only happened one time in about 5 years, I thought, you know, it's probably the rain blowing in from the wind when we get real high winds, you know, which is something that can happen if you've got a vent up there because it's open, you know, it's not completely closed.
Correct, yep, that can happen.
Okie doke. Thanks very much.
Well, thank you for calling in today.
I think we've been having a similar problem at home. We have a fan in the bathroom, and we noticed some water coming in through that, just a little bit. Is that the same
kind of thing? Completely different scenario for that.
Oh, really?
Yeah, David. Usually what will happen is if you've got a roof vent for a bathroom fan or even for a kitchen fan, when you're not using it, the warm air from the house, warm air rises, wants to go up through that fan and gets into the ductwork that ducts it out to the outside.
Mm-hmm.
Well, your warm, humid air gets into that cold attic air and the tube that's cold, and it can actually condense some of the moisture from the house in that tube. And I've found those tubes that actually had, you know, a quart or two of water in the low spots.
Huh.
And when it builds up enough, it starts dripping back out. Of course, it follows the tube back and comes in at the low spot, which is where the fan is. So I've seen them where we've actually had to put a warm air trap or a loop in the vent fan. If the vent comes off the fan, if you take it up to the ceiling or up to the roof framing and then let it drop down a foot or two, it puts kind of the a P-shape or a U-shape trap. You know, if you've seen the Drano commercial with the pipe going up and back down.
Uh-huh.
If you get that type of a bend in the pipe, then the warm air will tend to stay at the top and prevent a lot of air movement through there, so we don't end up with a lot of moist air going through it, so we don't end up with as much condensation. Otherwise, the flapper valve may be bad on it. Usually most of them have a little tin flapper, so when the fan is on, it opens up to the vent hose. When the fan is off, the flapper comes down. And if that flapper gets stuck or gets a piece of insulation or something in it, then again, it'll let a lot of the warm air from the bathroom up into the ductwork, and the ductwork will condense.
Well, I may have to call you again on that. I want to give just the information again here. We're talking to Scott Spies from Spies Home Repair or Home Inspection, sorry, in Champaign. We do this once a month to take your home improvement questions. And the numbers to call, 333-9455. And that also, there's a toll-free line, 800-222-9455. We have one caller on the line from Savoy on line one.
Yes, hello.
Good morning.
We've got a lot of concrete now that's broken up right up next to where our garage door comes down. So this year we're going to have new concrete put in. And my question is, first of all, is there any best time of year to have this done? And also, can we just do the section that's closest to the garage, or should we be doing it all at one time? Because there is a crack down the center if you go all the way down to the last section, which is fairly new because the city had to tear out curbs to lay down some new road work they did a couple years ago. So that's in good shape. But in any case, can we just do that one section this time and then another one another year? And when's the best time of year?
Well, most of the time concrete doesn't have a lot of weather issues other than freezing.
Okay.
Since it does have a water base that has to dry out of it, we don't want that water to freeze. They can make up some formulas that will cure faster for cold weather. But generally speaking, I like to see the concrete put in after we start getting some warmer weather. You'll get a little bit better cure. But you don't necessarily want to do it in the spring. We get a lot of rain, because if it rains on top of the concrete, then it can give you an improper mix, which then can lead to spalling and the fines coming to the surface. But, yeah, replacing one section should not be a problem. A crack down the middle of a section is, I don't want to say normal, but it's to be expected.
Okay, up near the driveway, it's just breaking up. But further out in the driveway is where we have this one long line in the middle. So I'm not as concerned about that as I am up near the garage where it's breaking up quite a bit.
Yeah, it's probably breaking up because of some settlement. When they put in the footing and everything for the garage and for the garage slab, if it didn't get the proper mixture of rock and sand and get compacted properly, you're probably getting a little bit of settlement right there in that area.
Okay, I was worried about melting snow and ice and then refreezing about the foundation, because that section would be right up, I guess, where the foundation would be. I assume there's foundation under the garage floor, right? So if that's been impacted in any way and cracked, I mean, would that be somebody different that would have to take care of that when they pull the concrete out, the old concrete?
I would doubt very, very much that you've actually affected the, particularly the footing, which is below frost level.
Okay.
But even the foundation itself, really the breaking of the concrete slab, which is only about 4 inches thick at the driveway, should not have any significant effect on the foundation. I would recommend when they pour the new section in, of course, that they put a bond breaker, which is a fiberboard piece between the garage slab and the driveway apron to allow for a differential movement, because we do get some frost heave action, and so your driveway apron needs to be able to move up and down as things freeze. When it gets quite cold, the soil under the concrete will freeze and lift it just a little bit.
Okay, a bond breaker between the garage slab and the driveway apron?
Yeah, the apron, which is the portion you're talking about replacing, the section of concrete directly outside the garage.
Right. Okay. Well, I guess that pretty much answers my question, and thank you very much.
All right. Well, thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank Bye-bye. You. And we have another caller on line two in Urbana, line two.
Hello. I had a suggestion for the person who had trouble with their doorbell.
Mm-hmm.
We just changed the battery, and the problem was solved.
That's a possibility as well, yes. A low battery can occasionally give you some interesting results.
Yeah, right.
All right. Well, thank you for that.
Sure. Bye.
Thank you. And we have another caller from Savoy on line three. Good morning.
Good morning. I have a question about sump pumps. Hello?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
And my sump pump empties outside, and I do have a water problem. It's an older house. But basically, I'm afraid I'm just recirculating the water. And the question is, where can I put the water? Can I put it out to the street for the storm sewers to take away?
For the most part, you're not supposed to connect directly to the storm sewer, and you're not supposed to pump directly out onto a street or onto a sidewalk. You're supposed to stay about 2 or 3 feet past or beyond that on your property and let the water travel out to there. In some cases, I've run into it where we've had sump pumps that have had to run on a regular basis. I mean, you know, probably every 3 or 4 minutes it kicked on for 6 months constant. In that case, they had to get a special permission to connect direct to a storm sewer so they didn't wash out the road ditch all the way down the street in front of all the neighbors. But yes, you can pump it out towards the street, but you can't pump it onto the street. You're supposed to let it drain out.
So if the outlet were to end 3 feet inside the sidewalk and the natural flow incline took it to the street, that would be legal?
Yes.
Okay, great. Thank you.
By my understanding, that is correct. All right, well, thank you for calling in.
Thanks. And we have another caller from Champaign on line one. Line one, good morning. Good morning. Champaign, you're on the air.
Hello.
Hello.
Hey, thank you for the tips on the antenna and so forth. 2 points. I have my house has one of those remote doorbells.
Uh-huh.
And strangely enough, if I'm using my charcoal grill and it's going at a pretty good rate within about 5 feet of the house, it sets that thing off like crazy for some reason. So those things are just spooky. I don't know what to do. And as a tip for Mr. Thiel there and anybody else who has a bath ventilator that has a condensation problem, I found if you replace the wall switch with a timer and set it, say, when somebody, especially after somebody's been bathing, set it so it'll run for, say, 20 minutes after you're done. So that way you suck out the rest of the moisture in the bath, and then force warm air through the pipe and the vent tube and facilitate the evaporation of any moisture that's in there. That helps a great deal. And of course, on those occasions when there's something rather malodorous in that particular private area, then it helps with that too. So it's just a tip.
Yeah, I definitely agree.
Thank
you. The timer on a bathroom vent fan is something that I've advocated for quite some time, because a timer does allow you to leave the fan on for 15 minutes or 20 minutes after you've taken a shower to pull any excess moisture out of the house. And so that's something that I do recommend. I hadn't thought of it as far as clearing the vents of any excess moisture, but yes, it would work that way as well.
Well, I tend to take very long showers, so that's important. Now, you know, the amazing thing is we seem to have answered everyone's questions.
Uh-huh.
We've solved it all this morning. My guest this morning is Scott Spies of Spies Home Inspection in Champaign, and I'm Program Director David Thiel for WILL-TV sitting in this morning. You can give us a call this morning at 833-9455, or you can call our toll-free line at 800-222-9455. And we have a caller on line one from Urbana. Good morning. Good morning, Urbana.
Hello. Would you know offhand, Scott, what's the R value of glass as opposed to like brick?
Oh, I don't have – I have not had any occasion to actually figure out what the R value was on brick. Glass is very low, like an R2. For a single pane, you can get it up to about an R4 with a double pane. We've got some claims a little bit higher than that with different coatings, particularly UV coatings and such between the panes. Brick doesn't do a real good job of insulating. It does a good job of being a time delay. When you get cold surface on the outside of the brick, it takes a while for the temperature to move through it. Likewise, in the morning when the sun hits it, the brick starts warming up, so your heat actually starts coming through in the afternoon. But that means that in the night when the brick cools down, the first thing in the morning, the cold comes through. So it doesn't really have that much of an R value, as it's more of a time buffer. I don't know exactly what you're looking at doing.
I was just curious, really.
That's something I could look up for you, but I don't know right off the top of my head.
Well, how would I look it up? What would I look under? Just R value or something?
I cheat and I ask my father, who seems to have the answer for all of these things after working with the University Small Homes Council for 35 years.
Uh-huh.
You might try and Google brick R value or something like that on the internet. It'll probably give you an idea.
Uh-huh.
But like I say, I know from experience that with a stone-faced house, that after the sun beats down on it all day long, the peak cooling actually happened about 10 o'clock at night, because that's how long it took for the heat to radiate through the limestone on the front of the house.
Did you look at that? Have you happened to look at that eco-friendly house up on the Fairview, which doesn't have a furnace but has tremendous insulation?
I have not had a chance. I've been interested in that, but things have been busy enough. I have not had a chance to go through that. Hope to do that sometime so I can get some ideas.
Uh-huh. Yeah, they said the highest electric bill is $150 and no furnace, and it's usually around $100. So pretty impressive.
Yes, it is. And that's the way we're going to need to be going here as things are getting higher and higher energy prices and the more we want to save our energy.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
All right. Well, thank you.
Thank you. We have a caller on line three back in Champaign. Champaign, good morning.
Hi. Good morning. We just bought a house last year. Actually, Mr. Spees inspected it. And we had a quick question for him. We were trying to find out what would be the cheapest way to reduce our electric bills, actually. We were thinking about replacing the windows, but we weren't sure if that would be worth it or not.
How old is the house?
It's about 1970s, I think.
Okay.
We have like two different dates for the construction date. The windows are a little older. They're like made out of aluminum.
Well, an aluminum frame prime window, yes, they do have a lot of heat transfer. Anytime you have a metal frame, they transfer heat pretty rapidly. So aluminum windows don't work great in this area. We've got a lot of the houses that were built that way, what we call the national homes, which we find it both in East Urbana and over the Holiday Park area in Champaign. And they have an aluminum storm window plus an aluminum prime window. And, yes, you can get condensation or even frost on the inside of the aluminum frames. In that particular case, about the only thing you can do is either put in an internal storm window, which would be a third pane, or to replace those windows. The wood frame windows, generally speaking, since the frames don't transfer heat, I don't like to see everybody saying, well, I need to throw my wood frame window away in favor of vinyl windows with double glazing, because a single glazed window with a good storm window has about the same energy efficiency as one of the double glazed windows, provided you've got proper weather stripping and such around the window. But if you've got an aluminum frame window, it's very difficult to prevent heat loss unless we get, like say, an internal storm window. I happen to have one of the national homes over there in the west side of Champaign, and what I do in the wintertime is I put in a I've built a frame where I can put a plexiglass internal storm window that keeps my warm house air from ever seeing those aluminum frames, so I don't get the condensation and the frost issues on there. And that does help the efficiency of the window quite a bit.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much.
And thank you. We have about 14 minutes left in the program, and we've got another caller on line one from Champaign. Good morning. Good morning, Champaign.
Oh, hi there. Name's Tom, and I have a storm drain. It gets roots in it about every 6 years. I've run a Roto-Rooter out 75 feet. I've tried putting muriatic acid. It's still not draining very well. I did get a lot of roots out of it. I don't know whether to go try rent a 100-foot Roto-Rooter and see if I can get it that far out. I don't know if I can.
Well, a lot of it's going to depend on what type of a tile you've got there. If you've got a clay tile, my guess is you've got enough cracks in it. And the root systems of the plant, shrubs, trees, et cetera, have already found the cracks. And so while you can cut the ones that have gotten into it, they're just going to grow very rapidly back into it, into the tile system.
Okay.
If it's a clay tile system, my guess is you're probably going to end up digging it back up and replacing it with a corrugated or a smooth PVC type tile to get it to function again. Sometimes it does help to flush a little bit of copper sulfate down, because the copper sulfate will tend to kill off the roots rather than just cutting them off. The muriatic acid yes, it will eat the roots, but it doesn't tend to stunt their growth, where the copper sulfate is almost a poison for the roots, so the tree wants to try and grow in other directions.
Well, I'll probably try that. I mean, I've got where I would have to dig it up. It's got trees, and it's going to be a big problem.
Well, I've heard of some systems that they can actually line some tiles, but for something like what you're looking at, my guess is the cost of the equipment and lining material would probably be about the same as replacing the pipe. I haven't done a cost analysis on that, so that's kind of a guess. But you might look into doing some pipe lining. But my gut feeling is that the pipe lining on a short distance small pipe like that is probably going to cost as much or more than replacing of the pipe.
Well, I'm pretty sure it's an old clay tile system.
That's kind of what I was thinking. And you've probably got enough cracks in the joints or splits in the pipe that, and of course, all the plants, all the hedges, all the trees, they find that moisture source in the ground, and they probably have that clay tile pretty well encased in roots.
I've cleaned it out. This is the third time in about 20 years, I guess. But this time doesn't seem to be.
If it's a root problem, you've probably got cracks and you're probably going to have to dig it up. I've seen some fill up with sediment, and that can be done. They've got a water jetting system that you can actually wash the systems out. But if you're cutting it and getting roots, that means you got some holes in that line, and it's going to need a little bit more repair.
Yeah. Okay.
All right. Well, good luck.
All right. Thank you.
Bye-bye. And we have about 10 minutes left in the program. Now we're, talking to Scott Spies of Spies Home Improvement. I keep wanting to say Home Inspection. I know. I don't know what's wrong with me. We're taking your calls this morning at 333-9455. And our toll-free line, 800-222-9455. Now, before the show, we had talked about, I guess this is the time of year to deal with your carbon monoxide detectors.
Well, the new laws in Illinois do require that all houses have to have a carbon monoxide detector unless you're an all-electric house and don't have the garage attached to the house. Even if you're all-electric but have a garage attached to the house, you are required to have a carbon monoxide by law to occupy the house. So it's a good idea. They've been in there. You know, the law has been out there for a year now. Most of the time, those detectors, if they're not a plug-in unit, the batteries will need to be checked, and even some of the plug-in units will have battery backups. So, your battery should be checked. Of course, you also want to check the ones in your fire and smoke alarms at the same time. But, it's definitely getting about that time. And a reminder to folks that you are supposed to have a carbon monoxide detector in the home. You want to have one. usually within each level of the house. Mm-hmm. If you got a basement, you should have one down there. Mm-hmm. Plus, you definitely want to have one within about 15 feet of all the doorways to the bedrooms. So if you've got a central hallway, you can put one in the hallway. It goes to each of the bedrooms as long as you're within about 15 feet. If they're located at opposite ends of the house, you should have one at each end of the house for the bedrooms. The other thing I've been running into this time of year, when we've got our freeze-thaw, you know, one day is 30 degrees, next day is 60 and raining, and then it drops down to 15 degrees. I've been getting a lot of phone calls at the office about condensation in attic areas, to the point where I actually had one where we had some water staining. Condensation in attic areas usually means a high humidity in the house, and when we've got a big temperature swing, it's not that uncommon, but you need to start looking for any excess moisture issues, particularly when we've had a year like this year where we've had a lot of days down in the 10 and 15 range.
Mm-hmm.
It takes very little moisture in the house to be relatively high compared to outside when it's that cold, because there's very little moisture outside. So what you would normally think to be the humidity level setting on your humidifier mm-hmm. is much, much too high when it's 5, 10, 15 degrees outside. So you need to make sure your power humidifiers get turned down. You might want to make, if you got moisture condensation, wake up in the morning, a little bit of water at the bottom of the windows, turn a bathroom vent fan on, let it run for a couple hours, and that'll help reduce some of the moisture problems that we're getting in the attic areas from the high humidity in the houses.
Very good. We've got about 8 minutes left in the show. We've actually got several calls backed up at the moment. I believe we have line one in Urbana. Good morning.
How are you?
Good morning. We're fine. What can we help you with?
We have a cedar shake roof on our house, and we're thinking of replacing it with another one. I just want to sort of get your opinion on, you know, is this a good idea? And secondly, what precautions should we do in installing it to make it last a little longer than the last one did?
Cedar shake roofing is a little on the tricky side. Part of it is trying to find good quality cedar. Second of all, cedar shake roofs of yesteryear, the ones that we find that lasted 50 and 60 years were put over the top of space sheathing. In other words, boards that had about a 2 or 3 inch gap. You'd have about a 4 inch board, then a 2 or 3 inch gap, and then a 4 inch board. And nowadays, we're putting over the top of a solid sheathing, a flake board sheathing. And the ones over the top of the flake board, because we're not getting as much air through them, do not last as long. They don't dry out, so they tend to rot a little bit sooner. So the combination. Go ahead.
We had a recommendation to put down this breather layer. I think it's about a quarter or 3/8 inch of sort of woven plastic to provide some more ventilation. Is this a worthwhile option? Or
Yes, for a long life on a cedar shingle, that is one of the keys, is to make sure that we get a lot of air moving around those shingles to keep them dried out. The other thing you might consider, and I found this trick strictly by accident. I did an inspection here in Champaign, and I noticed that the roof looked to be in awfully good condition, but the ends of the shingles looked like they had a little bit of moss on them. You get up there, and what had happened is the homeowner, prior to installing them, had left the bundles of shingles, had rolled a light, almost a mint green paint across the ends to seal the ends of the cedar shingles so that moisture wouldn't wick up into it. And these shingles, which were about 40 years old, were just in pristine condition because no water had wicked up in the ends. So that's something you might consider, putting a sealer or something. When the shingles come in still wrapped in the bundle, you can just take a paint roller, a long nap roller, and roll the ends of it, seal the ends of that cedar shingle, and I'll bet that'll help extend the life. Generally, a cedar shingle starts deteriorating from the bottom edge, water wicking up the wood grain. And so by sealing the end of that, that will help extend the life of it.
Thank you.
Certainly.
Thank you. And we've got a caller on line two from Champaign. Good morning, Champaign.
Yeah, hi.
Hi.
In terms of humidity, I've got a humidifier. 20 to 35 isn't very much humidity, is it really? Or not?
Well, when it's 5 degrees outside, yes, that is a lot.
Okay, right.
Let's face it, with a power humidifier and the control, you're setting relative humidity, relative to outdoor temperature, outdoor humidity levels, which is directly relative to outdoor temperature. When it's 5 degrees outside, there's very little moisture in the outside air, so we need very little moisture in the house to be twice or three times the amount of what's outside. So, yes, a 25 or 30 setting on your humidifier is much too high when it's 5 degrees out. Now, it's probably about right when it's 30 or 25 or something like that.
Okay, but 20 seemed pretty low. I mean, pretty dry, even when it was cold. Not down that cold.
The other thing you have to remember is that controller that you're using for your humidifier, in order for it to read the humidity level in the house, it has two little plastic strips, and they have to be in contact with the air. And after about the first 6 months or a year, or particularly after a remodeling project, there's a lot of dust flying around that can get on those plastic strips. So the accuracy of your controller may not be as good as what it used to be because of the dirt and debris that is collected on these strips, which are measuring the humidity in the house. So oftentimes if you get one that's not giving you good readings, you have to replace the controller. My general rule of thumb is if you're getting any moisture condensation at the bottom edge of a window, particularly a double pane window or a single pane with a storm window, then the humidity level in the house is too high. If you walk across a carpeted area and reach for the light switch and it reaches back with a little blue static zap, then it's just a little bit low. Or, for that matter, if you've reached out to pet Fluffy the cat and the cat gets this blue zap and won't talk to you for 3 days, hides under the bed, yes, you need a little bit more moisture in the house. But you want to try and keep it somewhere between those areas. The house itself would rather be dry. So if you're going to err on the dry side, particularly on our new construction where we have the houses built so tight that we're not getting rid of the moisture that's in the houses. The whole reason that mold and mildew has come to the forefront in the building area is because we've made these houses so tight that a little bit of moisture stays in the house for long periods of time, and that little bit of moisture can actually grow mold and mildew. So the drier you can keep the house, the happier the house is going to be.
Just an interest question. In terms of, you were talking about the clay tiles. When did they go out? In other words, they were in the houses that, in other words, built in the 50s or so, or up in the 70s, or when?
They actually did use it up into the 70s. In the 70s, they went to this new miracle, actually, sometime in the mid-60s. They went to this new miracle thing called Orangeburg, which actually does not work. they lasted about 20 years, and they just completely collapsed. And then they started going into PVC in the 70s, mid to late 70s. So, yeah, if you've got something that's older than 1960 and even up into 1965, there's a good chance it does have one of the clay tiles.
This is in was built in the 80s or 78. 79, so that would have that PVC or whatever it was.
Probably a flexible plastic, yes.
Yeah, those don't have the trouble with trees or not?
No, the tree roots don't get through the plastic. They don't crack as much. You can get some sediment in there, some dirt and debris washing through there, but usually not tree roots.
Okay, thanks a lot.
All right, we're going to have to be very quick here. We have one final call on line 3 in Champaign. You got about 2 minutes. Line 3, good morning.
Yes, my doorbell is not ringing, and I don't know what the function is in that box. What could be my problem?
Two things. Either the button goes, or actually three things. The button could go bad. Your 24-volt AC transformer could be either non-functional or not connected. In other words, a fuse or a breaker disconnected. Or it could be that the solenoid in the doorbell itself. First thing I'd do is go to the doorbell with a voltmeter and see if you've got 24 volts to the doorbell. If we do, that means the transformer's working. Try shorting across the doorbell connection on the doorbell, the button connection, and if the doorbell rings, then I would replace the button. So it's a matter of getting out a voltmeter and doing a little bit of quick chasing down of things to try and figure it out. Usually it's a 24-volt AC, not DC. Low voltage is enough you could, if on the doorbell, as long as you're not at the transformer, you know, if you touch it, you're not going to hurt yourself. The connections at the transformer, the 110-volt, of course, you want to be very careful with. It's supposed to be mounted on a junction box and enclosed where you can't get to it. But the screws with the fine wires on the outside of the transformer are only at 24-volt. They're not going to give you a nasty shock. It might feel a little unpleasant, but it's not going to hurt you any.
Thank you, sir.
All right.
Thank you, and that is going to wrap it up for today. And we've been talking to Scott Spies of
today.
Yeah, no, this has been terrific. No, we really appreciate the help because, as I've mentioned, I'm a little bit of an idiot on myself about this sort of thing, so it's always nice.